This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. The Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, is the successor to the now defunct Trans-Pacific Partnership after the withdrawal of the US last year. Malaysia is one of the signatory of the CPTPP, but my guests today have some reservations about this trade pact. Dr. Gudiel Singh Nija is the president of the National Human Rights Society. He recently wrote an op-ed outlining why he thinks free trade deals are not always free. Dr. Gudiel, welcome.
Thank you.
So what are your reservations about free trade deals in their current incarnations?
I must clarify right at the outset that I'm not against free trade because Malaysia is a trading nation and it requires trade agreements that facilitate that trade on a mutual balanced basis. The problem arises with the fact that we have now entrenched in this CPTPP trade agreement which we have signed but not ratified, so we are not obliged to follow it. A provision which relates to the investor, any investor who can sue our government. It is called Investor-State Dispute Settlement. In IS, it's called IS, it is abbreviated as ISDS. So it gives the power to international corporations to sue national governments for alleged loss of profits arising from any legal and regulatory measures that they may take after a corporation has come into the country, has established itself in the country, and even preparing to establish itself in the country. And the measures that the government may take would be measures that are in the national interest. For example, regulations to protect the safety of the public from toxic products, from environmental harm, protect workers' rights and other human rights. So any of this can now, under the definition of expropriation, be the subject of a suit by a multinational corporation.
Mm. Two things there. One is, why is it wrong for a foreign company going into a country for them to be deprived of this mechanism to look after their welfare? Because maybe they are not confident in that country's legal system for whatever reasons, they prefer a third-party arbitration. Why is that not acceptable, or why is it unfair?
Now, first is, when we look at Malaysia, Malaysia has a very developed and mature legal system. So, and we have adjudicated, our courts have adjudicated cases of all hue and colour involving multinational corporations as well. And that's a very important index for foreign direct investment. When they come in, they want to make sure the judicial system is acceptable, the economic climate is acceptable, the political stability is acceptable. And we have always attracted investments on that basis. So that is not a basis for now saying that we take this out. Because what is going to be, what the adjudicators in this case bypass the judicial normal court system. The matters are adjudicated by private lawyers who are not accountable to anyone and who revolve. I mean, one day the lawyer can be, an adjudicator, can be a judge. And day after tomorrow, he can be counsel for bringing a case against a particular state itself. So they virtually can create jobs for themselves by allowing for a very pro-trade and pro-investor kind of decisions. So this bypasses the judicial system completely. I mean, the Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia, for example, says that this system is completely undermines the judicial system in the country, that you have three trade lawyers deciding on the fate of what laws in the national interest a country can or cannot take. Now, this is the problem. I just want to emphasize, you see, they allow for, in the past, under the previous ISDS kind of provisions, a company could complain if their investment was expropriated. In other words, you stop them from continuing their operations. They say, look, we came in on an understanding, and now you've taken away our investment. But here, it allows also for what we call indirect expropriation. This is very widely defined as any distinct, reasonable investment-backed expectation of the investor. And so if this means that they can complain if they feel you have reduced the value of their investment. And what is reasonable is to be decided by this private panel of lawyers who are not accountable to anybody at all.
Who decides the composition of this people who sit on this panel?
This is decided by the disputants in the party, right? So investor will choose, and the state that is affected also will choose, and then they'll have a third judge. But this is confined to a very small group of people, white people. There are hardly any Asians on this panel, and they monopolize this almost as to, I think, 70-80% of the cases. Now, even if you nominate one judge, there have been many cases where the dissenting judge, there's 2-1 decisions, and the dissenting judge has said, look, this panel has completely missed the point and has created situations which nullify the effect of national laws and national policies.
Could you give an example of what is the worst case scenario for Malaysia if this is taken to the extreme in the ISDS tribunal?
Okay, we just take an example. Supposing we were already parties to this CPP-TPP. And there is in existence a company which is allowed in, which has come to an arrangement with one of the states. And it produces, what it produces is something that the people in that region or in the country complain about as having a toxic effect and affects impairs their health and safety and so on. And then the government, a people-centric government, comes in and says, yes, it listens to the people and says, yes, we have to do something about this. We have to listen to the people. And if necessary, we might have to curtail the operations, maybe impose stricter regulations, or even at some point say that, look, you know, this is not in the interest of the country. Now, if we were members of CPP-TPP, we would be sued. Why? Because they would say that you have affected the climate within which the economic climate, the investment climate that was promised to us when we located ourselves in your country. So this really reduces the policy space for governments to act in the best interest of their people. There is a provision on which most of these suits are based, and that is called minimum standards of treatment. They have to be fair and equitable. So you have to treat the investor fairly and equitably. But this is decided. This is not defined and is decided by this panel of lawyers in strange ways. For example, Ecuador. Ecuador took action on behalf of its people because this company called Occidental was, its operations were affecting the interest of the people. People complained, their health was being affected by the oil operations and so on. And the Occidental had gone and assigned their interests illegally to another company. It was against the contractual provision. It was also against the constitution of the country. So the courts acted and said that this is illegal. But they brought a case, Occidental brought a case, and the court and the panel of arbitrators hearing this ISDS-type suit said that we acknowledge that a contractual provision has been breached and that there's a constitutional impact and so on, but you have not treated them fairly and equitably and proportionally. And so they ordered billions of dollars that Ecuador is still struggling to pay to this investor.
Mm. But the adjudicators or the lawyers or judges that sits on this panel, they are confined by the parameters of what the agreement says, isn't it? Isn't the onus on the countries or the states to, you know, define clearly what they can and cannot do before they go into an agreement with or invite companies to invest in their country?
No, you see, this ISDS is outside of those contracts. You see, there's an agreement made between a country to come into that country to establish a factory, for example. But then this it supersedes the whole ISDS provision that you sign into as a trade agreement with that country, allows the investor to sue you under the provisions of this ISDS provision, which is extraneous to the whole agreement, as happened in the Ecuador case, because they acted illegally under that contract. It was clear. Even the panel of lawyers admitted that it was. But they said that that did not matter. And that is why you have lots of university professors and other commentators, even UN expert groups, saying that this is quite a ridiculous system where you allow a panel of people to adjudicate and interfere with your legislative process. It is actually against the rule of law, because how can we, for example, Parliament decides, our Parliament decides, and then if the Parliament does right or wrong, it goes to the courts, and that's the rule of law, the separation of powers. But here you have an external group of people who are trade lawyers, primarily white, nothing to do with the country. They can adjudicate and say that what you did was wrong, and it will have an intrusive, chilling effect on our parliament, on our parliamentarians, because next time you do not pass a law like this, because you're going to involve the country in a commitment which could be damages payable in billions of dollars.
So the deadline to ratify this CPTPP is next February. We have signed on to the agreement but have not ratified it. Let's take a short break now. When we come back, we'll discuss further what this means in terms of the legal implication, as well as what alternatives does a country like Malaysia have if we want to, you know, continue to be an open market where we trade but not put us in this situation where we are subjected to ISDS in an unfair manner. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. With me today, Dr. Gurdjieff Singh Nija, President of the National Human Rights Society, also known by their acronym HAKAM. We're discussing an op-ed that Gurdjieff has wrote discussing his reservations about free trade deals. One in particular, CPTPP, which Malaysia has to decide whether or not it wants to be a part of. The deadline to ratify it is next February. So we are a signatory to it. So one of 11 countries, three have ratified it. What are the legal implications, you know, if we stick to the status quo, if we do nothing else?
Well, just before that, if you will allow me, it has also been suggested, for example, by some of our policymakers that we need not worry about the ill effects because under the CPTPP, the ISDS provisions have been suspended, they say. So don't worry about ISDS.
So and there's no mechanism for investors to sue the state?
Well, this is what I want to go into a little bit, because they are saying that, you know, it is suspended in two situations where there's a breach of an investment agreement and an investment authorization. But if you look closely at the suspension, it's only in respect of a marginal set of situations. So to qualify for this suspension, this investment agreement, some of the key aspects are it must be concluded and takes effect after the CPTPP enters into force, which means previous agreements, for example, the agreement that we have in relation to ECRL, for example, we want to renegotiate it. Or some of the companies that are already in existence whose operations are or may be subject to review because they have some deleterious effects, they will not be covered at all. And then it must be between the central level of government, federal government, and the investor. So if it is, for example, with the state, you know, for example, Penang has agreements, you know, with international companies that are quite noted, as does Pahang and several other governments. So that will not be covered. And it's only for rights granted with respect to natural resources controlled by a national authority. All right. So if you have a bauxite mine, for example, or you have a gold mine, or you have a, what do you call it, this, like the Raub gold mining and so on and so forth, operations, that's not controlled by a national authority, it's a state authority. And also it is for rights granted to supply services on behalf of the party for consumption by the public for power generation, water, telecommunications and such like, or to undertake infrastructure projects that is not for exclusive or predominant use and benefit. So you see, there is a very limited kind of suspension. And also, we must not forget, suspension is suspension. It's not the complete takeaway of the right. So it only relates to future agreements with the federal government. It does not cover the renegotiation. So, for example, if today the CPP-TPP is in force, agreements like ECRL and HSR will be subject to the ISDS provisions, for which we could end up paying billions well beyond, because there's no cap. Mm-hmm. So you deny them the profits, right, for as long as they would want to be in operation under the agreement that you have given them.
Even if China is not a party to this trade pact, a Chinese-based company can initiate such ISDS actions?
Well, I mean, it's generally speaking, it is only subject to that which is under parties to the agreement. But, you know, corporations find their ways of dealing with this. For example, when Australia introduced the plain packaging for tobacco, first the tobacco companies sued in the Australian courts, right up to the apex court. They lost. And then what they did, they went and registered themselves in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong had an agreement with ISDS. So companies can be very mobile. So they moved there. And then they sued under the ISDS provision. Now they got knocked off on a technicality. And then now they are going through the WTO, right? So you see, corporations weave their way into positions in which they can get these kind of benefits. And it's very easy for companies to get incorporated in whichever jurisdiction they want, provided they satisfy those criteria.
So nothing short of a complete removal of these provisions would satisfy you before Malaysia wants to be a part of this?
Yes, agreement. Because you see, what we should do really is we have to make a reservation about this ISDS provision. It should not be made applicable. There are countries that have already done that. There are countries in BITS, which is the bilateral investment treaties, where there is an ISDS provisions, and they have opted out of this provision or opted out altogether with that bilateral treaty. And you have countries like Indonesia, which was hit by this kind of a provision, had to end up paying a lot of money. You have India, you have South Africa. So you have a large number of countries, even Europe, for example. Now, what Europe has suggested is in its bilateral agreement, I think, with the US, it has suggested that there must be an international judicial tribunal, for example. And it has embedded this provision in its bilateral agreement with Vietnam and Canada. So this ISDS provision is a real hindrance to having a balanced agreement where we can feel comfortable that we are not unduly dealing with the foreign investor, because we want foreign investment. So, you know, under our liberal economic program, we want to attract. But at the same time, we must not be denied policy space to act our laws in the best interest of our country. And we must be allowed to have our judicial system as the primary judicial system that will adjudicate. And you cannot interfere with the will of the people as expressed through laws made by Parliament. Now, all of this is something that are being, if you look at the several cases throughout the world, you know, that have been happening, are being compromised because of ISDS adjudication. So we have to find alternative to ISDS, which, for example, Europe, as I've said, is doing through an international judicial tribunal. Or we have to have a hybrid domestic international tribunal, such as exists in the international criminal law area, right? We have the ICC, International Criminal Court, but at the same time, we have our national courts. And or some kind of a trans-Pacific political risk insurance fund, or perhaps a TPP dispute avoidance and mediation facility. In other words, we have to get rid of all the ugly features that ISDS has come to represent throughout the world in similar kind of ISDS provisions.
How are those alternatives you mentioned better or more fair than what the ISDS have? Like, how do you make sure that something like the ICC is accountable, or they have a better diversity in terms of their representation?
Well, because here you see, for example, the ICC is set up by an international body, so it's subject to international monitoring, reporting of decisions and so on, and of having their decisions assessed, for example, right, and reviewed at some stage. But here, this is a private, you know, these are just private lawyers, trade lawyers. It's a small group of lawyers who are making tons of money by adjudicating matters, one day as a judge, another day as counsel in this matter. And they are not accountable to anybody. They say, yes, the conflict of interest situation will be looked at by through some voluntary guidance, but there's nothing specific. So they're a law unto themselves. And that is why people like Joseph Stiglitz, you know, and even Tribe, who was the Obama's mentor at Harvard University, and several others, UN expert groups, have said that this ISDS system is a free plate handover to multinational corporations to make money by looking at situations where they can fault governments for wanting to take matters or policy, implement policies in favor of their people. For example, Argentina wanted to stop a facility because it was its impact on people was on the people who complained was very severe. They got sued for billions of dollars. You have countries like Guatemala, even Canada, even Germany. Germany, after the Fukushima, wanted to space out its nuclear facilities. They are being sued by the Swedish company that had the nuclear plant set up in the first place. So you can see how it restricts so completely the space, the policy space for governments to act in the best interest of their people.
Mm. All these reservations were present and during the TPP negotiations, yet it was agreed to by all the parties. And right now, with the latest incarnation with the TPP, three countries have signed on to it, Mexico, Japan, and Singapore. What is it that they see in this that is favorable to them if ISDS is such a harmful tool to sovereignty and the rule of law? Is this a geopolitical play rather than an economics trade pact, as most proponents of it would like us to believe?
Well, two things. First is, whether it's geopolitical or not, I think when the U.S. was pushing for the TPP before Trump came in and removed it. It was all the countries in the world, a large number of the trading nations were included, and all those in and around China were included, but China was excluded, which gave rise to some serious concerns that this was an attempt to foreclose the development and progress of China in terms of their trade relations with others. But aside from that, our own country, as you would recall, under the previous administration, approved the TPP. They said they went around consultation. Now, it's a document of 600 pages, but they say they went around the country and informed the people, and the people consented to it. I, as a lawyer of many, many years, until today, I'm still grappling with a lot of the key provisions of the trade agreement.
And it's more than 6,000 pages, isn't it?
Sorry, 6,000, not 600. 6,000 pages. And then I was at the gallery when this, where there was a debate on the TPP. It was not a partisan debate. People just voted. It was one day's debate of 6,000 pages. And nobody really talked about ISDS and its pernicious impacts. Mm. So it is a question of rushing in where angels fear to tread sometimes. So I don't know what is the motive force for Singapore, Mexico, and Japan. They must have their own interest in wanting these provisions. I don't know who are the lobbies in theirs, but we must not forget that our previous government also wanted this. And it is hoped that our present government now, being people-centric, will look at it carefully before they have signed onto it, but it does not affect us until we have changed our laws. I think we have to change something like our 80 laws, I think, some of which are very beneficial to our people, small farmers, for example. And then we notify the depository of the CPP, TPP, that we have changed our laws, and 60 days after that, it will come into effect. There's no time limit for us. So I think this new government, it's still in its, you know, if I could say so, although the Prime Minister, of course, is, fully experienced, but the rest, a lot of them are just grappling with coming into to terms with their ministries and their objectives and so on and so forth. I think we have to tarry a while, be a little cautious, and look at this carefully from all sides. I understand that our Prime Minister is very concerned about its impacts. And in fact, I participated in one of the meetings that was called by the Prime Minister itself to look at various facets of this. So I think we have to look very carefully at this before we ratify and tie ourselves into this. You see, we can do bilaterals. We are, in fact, if you look at the countries, we have agreement with most of the countries except for two or three already. So in terms of trade, there is no impediment. And there's nothing to stop us having a direct trade agreement with some of the countries. There are countries like Brazil, for example, who are not in any of these kind of agreements which have ISDS, and their trade has flourished. If the Joseph Stiglitz, who was here recently, and he's a Nobel laureate, so, you know, we've got to accord his views some respect. He said that, you know, investors do not necessarily think in terms of joining an agreement like CPP, TPP as a basis for the growth for trade. In fact, he says what investors, and I think it's fairly obvious, they give higher value to good infrastructure, supporting industries, educated and skilled manpower, rule of law, political stability. These are the factors, for example, that will motivate direct investments. And Malaysia has all of these. And when we go, we want to be a developed nation soon, when we go and have our dealings with other nations on a bilateral basis, it's perfect. We face a lot of challenges. You know, for example, our palm oil industry faces a lot of challenges. What if there is a kind of an investment which has an impact upon that? I mean, we do not know how this will pan out in the future. So it's best to do bilateral, and we have good negotiators, trade negotiators, to focus their interests on developing this balanced kind of a trade which does not have these kind of negative aspects which almost the entire world, especially lawyers, professors, economists, have warned against, this ISDS provision.
Mm. What about the argument that, you know, as a relatively small country, you need strength in numbers in terms of getting your voice heard when negotiating free trade agreements with a larger country or larger bloc of countries? There are also arguments about how going into multilateral trade agreements like this and having to comply with ratification requirements will help accelerate reform agendas like, you know, all the things you mentioned, labor, transparency, anti-corruption.
Yes, but what we have to do is we have to balance the costs and the benefits, even in terms of, this is actually not a trade agreement as such. Direct trade aspects are only about 20%, it has been calculated. The rest are, you know, to control other facets, for example, you know, patent rights with regard to medicine, what you can and cannot do, whether you can reduce the price, whether you can have parallel imports and so on and so forth. So if you look at the pros and cons, and I will quote Stiglitz, who was here recently, invited by Khazanah for a forum, and who's a renowned Nobel laureate in economics. He said, and I will quote, "There is simply no sense to be part of the CPP-TPP if we start considering the costs such as burdensome intellectual property rights for critical medicines, liberalizing government and GLC's procurements, and the high potential of being sued in a foreign private court, the ISDS mechanism, for billions of dollars." And I think we got to listen to the wisdom of some of these people who have looked at these provisions very carefully and have spent a large part of their life in the last couple of years looking at the pros and cons, and be cautious before we step into this agreement.
So, finally, there seems to be some moves in the PH or Pakatan government to amend our domestic laws so that they align or comply with CPTPP. Any parting words for our lawmakers?
Yes, I think we have to review that aspect very carefully, because last time under the previous government, we just rushed in because we had to satisfy the template that was provided for us by the U.S., dictated to us by the U.S. largely. Now, we, and I remember very clearly during that time, there is one specific one. For example, we have a Plant Variety Protection Act. You see, big corporations come in, they can add to seeds, for example, that farmers produce, or plants that farmers create, you know, add a little bit of this, that, and the other, and then say, and claim patent-like rights in respect of it and monopolize that so no one else can have it. Now, we have had to provide for that kind of patent rights under the WTO provision, but we are allowed to set up our own system as well. So for small farmers, we provided an exemption for small farmers to carry on their age-old practice of growing their seeds, exchanging it across the fence with other farmers, making it available in the market in pasar malams and places like that. Now, all that, the U.S. wanted that provision, that law to be, that provision in that law to be removed. And I recall talking to the then Ministry of Agriculture chiefs that we have to allow for, in the long run, food security of sorts. And we have to allow also our small farmers to continue. But they said, ultimately, they said, well, it's too bad because, you know, our government wants to fast-track the TPP engagement and ratification, and that's what the U.S. insists on, so we're sorry. So you see how the changing of the laws is at the behest or for purposes that may be extraneous to a people-centered government like the PH government. So the PH government, I think, must review. We have got a very enlightened attorney general who will be responsible for the changes in the laws, as well as his officers in various ministries, you know, in agriculture, in environment, in natural resources. And I think we have to review this very, very carefully and not just be influenced by policies that are being put forward by trade enthusiasts.
In we have to do something before February, right? We have to indicate a response or something as to whether we want to proceed or not.
No, there is no time limit.
Okay.
There's no time limit for us. There is no disadvantage to us. I think Stiglitz and others also have mentioned there is no need to rush in because Vietnam is rushing in and we will lose any advantage. We lose no advantage at all. That has been made clear. And we can take our time, and we will not be bound. We have signed, but since we have not ratified, we are not bound. So we should take our time to assess the agreement and its impact upon our people, and our government.
Even when six of the countries sign it, which would then make the pact come into force, it wouldn't still affect us?
Yes, it will not affect us. It will only affect those countries which have changed their laws and have deposited their consent, their ratification, and then only 60 days after that. So there's no penalty. We can remain on the books as signatories to this agreement. And when the time is ripe and after we have had mature discussion with stakeholders, careful and anxious discussion, and we know that our Prime Minister is committed to this kind of consultation, then I think we should consider very carefully whether to ratify or not.
Dr. Goodale, always a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.